had a good lunch, and very much looking forward to the afternoon and final leg of the 2011 SILT. I hope you're all as energized by these conversations as I am. In fact, I know you are. It's a great pleasure to have David Dark join us for SILT 2011. I've admired David's writing over the past 8 or 10 years. You may have read his essays and reviews, music reviews in Books and Culture or Paste or the other journal. Where else do you write? Christian Century, everywhere. Did you ever write for Oxford American? Yeah, I thought I saw something of yours there. That's a great magazine. You know, before you began graduate school, you had written two beautiful books, one called Everyday Apocalypse, The Sacred Revealed, and Radiohead, The Simpsons and Other Culture Icons, and The Gospel According to America, A Meditation on a God-Blessed, Christ-Haunted Idea. David studied English at Middle Tennessee State University, was writing criticism, reviews, books, and decided to try his hand in graduate school and took a class or two at Duke and Vanderbilt in the Vanderbilt Divinity School. I guess John McClure and some others noticed this talent, and he was accepted into the PhD program. And 4 years later, without any theological formal training, he finished his dissertation last week, and that's got to be some kind of a record. So good for you. During which time, he also wrote another book called The Question, The Sacred Art of Questioning, Sacredness of Questioning Everything. So so that's David Dark. He also contributed to the chapter in the book, Radiohead and Philosophy. I didn't know you did that. Fitter, Happier, More Deductive. Following years of teaching high school, recently defended his dissertation. The dissertation was titled Insert Soul Here, which is not a line from a Radiohead song. It's you. It's David Dark. The witness of sacramental poetics as apocalyptic for the people. He's a native of Nashville and says he attempts to raise children and live a life of mindfulness with his fabulous singer-songwriter wife, Sarah Mason, whose music I commend to you if you haven't heard her work already. So welcome.
I want to make this as interactive as possible. I mean, I will do the reading thing, but talk to me. I don't guess it's appropriate to interrupt me. I mean, we want a constant, right? So we will have the constant, and but back and forth. I thrive on back and forth. It sustains me. I don't know what to do without back and forth. Okay, Everyday Apocalypse. Writing Lived Theology, and I have this opening quote that is intended to evoke something, and hopefully it'll make sense as we go. Here's the opening quote. Perhaps this is the mysterious it of the common phrase, it is snowing, what we are always inside of. I'm going to repeat it. Perhaps this is the mysterious it of the common phrase, it is snowing, what we are always inside of. Joshua Clover, The Bubble in the Globe. And actually, I'm going to do what you did because I found it really helpful, you know, kind of give your sections so we know what's coming. So here's the sections, and I hope I get to all of them. The Conned Man. I don't have Heidegger's Hut. I mean, that'll always be a mystery. What's in there? And I love these section headings so much that on one, I had to do two of them, two section headings. So it's like or. Okay, so The Conned Man, and then religion is non-optional, or you've got to be in it to win it. And another one, every telling has a tailing, or on being able to say everything. And then, I sure hope I get to all of these, apocalyptic for the people. And the way we look to a song. It is a Paul Simon line. And I figured it was okay because you had you quoted somebody quoting Madonna. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. A material person in a material world. That was a Madonna evocation. Yes, yes. Okay. I mean, I could tell. Apocalyptic for the people. Do you know what I'm referring to with the Yeah, automatic for the people. Okay. Meanwhile on the lower frequencies. Anybody? Meanwhile on the lower frequencies, is that doing anything? It's not what's the frequency, Kenneth. Okay, a Ralph Ellison line, and we'll get to that. Sacramental poetics as illegal thinking. And insert soul here, it ends with. And I'll just tell you now, the last sentence is insert soul here. So just be ready for that when it comes. That's the last sentence. Okay, the conned man. Here's the way it went. I sat eating and reading alone at a table. I'm so sorry I'm cracking up. I don't know what to do. I'm sorry. Here's the way it went. I sat eating and reading alone at a table in a Nashville location of the Wendy's old-fashioned hamburgers franchise when I spotted out of my periphery a heavy man at a table nearby with a collection of shopping bags on the floor next to his chair. He ate quickly, but his face registered no agitation as he stared straight ahead. Upon finishing his meal, he made his way to the door. From there, the restaurant's large glass windows afforded me a view of the man's progress across the parking lot, and I was intrigued to note that his next destination was a Domino's Pizza at the nearest corner of a strip mall just a few yards away. Within minutes, he exited with a Domino's bag added to his collection and went directly into a TCBY. Do we know what TCBY is? The country's best yogurt. He followed the same pattern as he exited with a new bag, and then finished off, as far as I could tell, with a Subway restaurant next door, disappearing around the corner with bags in both hands. I've seen him around town many times since, always bearing a diversely branded burden that may or may not contain brand products within. Reflecting upon this episode, I began to concoct a thought experiment. What if the fellow suffered from an emotional disorder that rendered him incapable of incredulity and therefore peculiarly vulnerable to commercial claims? So vulnerable, in fact, that he believed, could not not believe, all commercials. Whereas most people appear capable of filtering out the myriad forms of sales pitch, guarantee, promise, and false covenant foisted upon public minds via billboards, posters, product placement, and all manner of electronic media, perhaps this unfortunate soul could not. And if this were the case, I reasoned, something as seemingly insignificant as exposure to a 3-minute commercial break might suffice to send him on his way searching, enthralled, along a perverse pilgrimage that would consume the length of his progressively less healthy life. Are you all with me following the story? Okay. Sorry for needing that. I'm sorry for appearing human in front of you. In this way, he is successfully enlisted in an endless series of faith-based initiatives, provoked by and based in the alluringly situated but necessarily insincere signals, the deliberate fictions of a myriad-minded brand culture, which, taken together, render him the subject of what amounts to a kind of cruel psychological experiment. His work, we understand, will be cut out for him as he tries to live it, as it were, and advertising strategies ostensibly crafted to move a few units, to sell a little confidence here and there, will have unwittingly come together to reduce the beleaguered existence of an impressionable mind to a soul-sucking nightmare. When I spotted this fellow and started writing these sorts of things down, I had yet to hear tell of a habitus. I'd read Zero Certo, and nobody had taken me aside to propose the PhD state of mind, a strange world where I could do the kind of reading and writing I was already doing during my planning periods at a Presbyterian high school, find out how to pronounce Walter Benjamin's name, Benjamin. They start, Ted Smith said Benjamin. I thought, oh, shoot, I had it wrong. Benjamin. Did y'all say Benjamin? Would that happen? Okay. I said Benjamin for years. Can I? Would it be all right? You would accept me? Okay. I'm going to say Benjamin because I'm still scared. find out how to pronounce Walter Benjamin's name, and receive a credential that might gain me a new teaching gig at a college or university. If you'd asked me what I thought of lived theology, I'd have likely channeled my inner Will Campbell to say, it's my preferred kind, and I have a go at it myself on occasion. Somewhere back there, following a lecture I gave in Chicago that involved thinking through the War on Terror, the Barman Declaration, and the music of Radiohead, a graduate student asked me what my methodology was. I didn't know what to say beyond saying, I take notes and collect quotes, which I bring to bear on whatever artist, issue, or event interests me. He was satisfied, but if he pressed me further, I suppose I'd have cited Charles Williams' Way of Affirmation, which he saw modeled in Dante, figure of Beatrice, the work of saying what we see, what I'd learned to call this way of affirmation, I'd learned to call, under the burden of a dissertation, the sacramental poetic work of paying attention. And I'm good with that, actually. I like sacramental poetics as a way of talking. I tried religio-poetic witness for a while, and that was horrible. I got delivered from that, but I had a week or two when I thought I was going to write a dissertation on religio-poetic witness. We're okay now, it's sacramental poetics. Okay. In the case of the conned man, I saw, or imagined I saw, at Wendy's old-fashioned hamburgers, I took note and it remained in my memory because I often shared the scene with my students in the hope of cultivating and modeling critical consciousness, a work I find indistinguishable from the theological task of discerning the spirits and unmasking idolatry, though I don't always find it fitting to put it that way. My model here, as it often is Marshall McLuhan, who posited this apocalyptic sensibility in 1951 with this question, this rhetorical question, why not assist the public to observe consciously the drama which is intended to operate upon it unconsciously? Equip the public to observe consciously the drama that's intended to operate upon it unconsciously. In the context of a PhD program, I found that the tale of the conned man could serve as an instructive caricature in taking up the problematic of religion, the ways the religious sphere has been conventionally ordained, and how religion as a category might be more meaningfully and critically deployed. The mental bind, the illusion, in which the conned man lives, moves, and has his being, need not involve theistic confessions or metaphysical claims to be understood as an ineluctably religious one, religio as binding influence. And the same goes for the high-budget, high-tech processes of religious formation, renewed, redeployed, and made new every morning, within which his emotional health is continually compromised. He has become what various brand agencies once beheld and in fact bargained for when they took a theoretical interest in him or his type as a potential target market. Such interest is admittedly limited to his purchasing capacity, but an advertising campaign to be successful must seek to address the whole self, the everyday emotional life of individuals, with the imaginative constructions of brand culture, no less binding we understand for being mere constructions. The narrative associations of a brand are designed to prey upon and cater to every discerned aspect of the individual's social imagination, conjuring desired behavior by creating, if only momentarily, a loss of identity that can be most reliably recovered by way of accessing a certain proffered product. The con man has received and incorporated, or perhaps been incorporated by, these calls to worship, these carefully calibrated mystifications, one after another, and has come to believe that the answer to his meaning problem, we all have them, resides within these stories in which he's been successfully enlisted. He will know no lasting satisfaction on his quest because too much is never enough, and as my caricature has it, he won't stop believing. He's an ensnared civilian emerged in a religious crisis. What do we gain by considering the plight of the conned man through the lens of religion? By doing so, we're afforded a tool for critically examining the kind of immersive campaigns that go some distance in overcoming his powers of discernment, a space for raising the question of agency, always a religious question, for this mobile buyer moving through a fantasized space, and a pivot point for envisioning the possibility of creative countermeasures. In this way, religion is a term that characterizes the net we're held within, whether willingly or unconsciously, a net that is alternately woven and unwoven. And I won't be able to get into it in time, but Joyce informs McLuhan's understanding of these things, kind of weaving and an unweaving, down to moments in Ulysses where even the idea of text or a sutra or something like that, this weaving, unweaving thing that goes on. If, as is the case with the conned man, we see religion as a kind of nightmare from which we mean to awaken, the awakening itself is also religious. As a thick accounting of practice, religion names the binding and the loosing of hearts and minds, the entrenched means to status quo fulfillment, as well as the open spaces that lay outside them. The rituals to which the likes of the conned man would have been converted to, as well as those they've been converted from, all are illumined and brought into dramatic relief by the problematic of religion. In the interest of widening the scope and applicability of the conned man's clinically gullible imagination, the caricature might be helpfully moved beyond fast food franchises to include other forms of brand culture. Consider the ostensibly mature adult whose waking moments expend primary energy not towards self-actualization or discerning and meeting the needs of a close relative or neighbor, but to feeling rage toward famous strangers. Competing media pundits, celebrity politicians, sports figures, or participants on a televised dance competition. Imagine the armchair activist emailers anywhere along the ideological spectrum who primarily speak in conversation stoppers, who can't change their minds and won't change the subject. Consider also the consumer of luxury goods, the talk radio enthusiasts, the political party apparatchik, the soul whose emotional life is increasingly enthralled by and conducted through online social networks, or the magnetic pull of an Apple store. While largely uncoerced and free to weave their way amid distractions, commodities, and various service options, these figures are obedient to certain scripts and symbols of human flourishing, characteristic of brand culture, even as they convert their attention from one distraction to another many times on a given day. While their consciences evade, to some extent, the endless moral injury of the conned man, any attempt to represent these phenomena in a non-compartmentalized fashion will return us to the question of religion, or to risk redundancy, the issue of performed religiosity remains in play. Religion as practice as opposed to conscious profession. Guess I want to throw in on this the redundancy. We'll get to witness, it's come up, but we were talking lived witness. I would think is already a redundancy, because what is it? If it's not, and was it Philip Berrigan who said, don't just do something, stand there. And that's his definition of witness, that it is a stand. It's what we ascribe when we tell one another. A professor gave me a B, and I told him, you know, I wasn't joking, I was trying to deal with it. I said, you know, I receive your witness on this. And he knew that I wasn't joking, because I thought he was right. I mean, it wasn't just I'm trying to be nice to you. It was the best thing I could come up with to let him know that that exchange that came up was happening. Okay, I'm sorry. Though I know it's more interesting when you're like, oh, here he goes again. He's going to read on. Okay, if we think religion is practice as opposed to conscious profession, if we think of a brand campaign as a form of proselytization, the strategies and tactics at work within reigning technopolies challenge the popular separation of the merely secular from the ostensibly sacred. Whether geared towards securing votes, moving units, developing a following, selling tickets, or organizing military recruitment, the colonization of the targeted imagination from whatever sphere will ignore our habitual distinctions. Frames of mind and forms of consent are being religiously cultivated and maintained through popular postures of passive reception upon which successful conscription is performed. This is the exchange of confidence connoted in the work of con artistry. The con game of the con artist is a matter of selling confidence. If religion is a thick descriptor of the instruction we've received, for better and worse, it is both the terrain of the con and the naming of said terrain. Religion is the name of the con game. If to be conned is human, confessing to having been conned is an act of religious awareness. Is this making sense? Okay, now, I'm sorry, that was that one section. So I'm just going to have to, okay, I'm going to read this part. Here's the next one: the religion is non-optional, or you have to be in it to win it. Against accounts of religion which imply that it operates in a space outside of everyday practices, concerns, and motivations, the theory of religion I posit keeps the question of religion open, allowing it to designate any number of social bonds, avowedly religious or otherwise, and even everyday practice. A few times in the book where it would say religious practices as being among everyday practice, I would write next to it, why not just everyday practices? And that's maybe something we could talk about, but I don't know. Similarly, when people say, why are you studying religion? I want to say, what else is there? As in, it names all of this. I had to skip this part, but Wallace Stevens talked about binding and freeing artifice. And that might be a helpful way, because it's kind of a neutral social fact, you know, rather than, okay, binding, freeing artifice. I'm going to have to skip this, because we're not going to... Talal Asad talks about religious belief, which I think is also a redundancy, religious belief, as a constituting activity in the world. And I want to say the constituting activity, if we have to use the word. It's a helpful, critical tool. Okay, understanding with Marx that religion can effectively name those forms of consolation, otherworldly and or market-driven, which anesthetize the popular imagination into submission, the illusory happiness of the con man and his ilk, there is nevertheless more to the picture. Marx also gives us the more comprehensive account in which religion names as well the stock inventory of word and image on offer for narrating historical processes, an assemblage of ways of putting matters, explaining the hows and whys of life and how it might yet or should be lived. Famous Marx quote, religion is the general theory of the world, of this world, its encyclopedic compendium, its logic in popular form. The wretchedness of religion is at once an expression of and protest against real wretchedness. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. As an expression of material wretchedness that is also a protest against it, Marx views religion as a form of creative labor. This language recasts religion as not merely the opiate of the masses, but more broadly the poetics of the people. Like ritual, symbol, or ceremony, religion isn't something one can be for or against or decide to somehow suddenly engage. Religious traditions are always already underway. You can never step in the same one twice. Their engagement precedes us, having already formed our imaginaries. It's in this sense that Marx insists that the critique of religion is the prerequisite of every critique. And I'm going to make myself skip some, but I'll throw in, as we move toward witness, one provocation that shows up on the irreligious, non-religious kind of thing is, show me your gas mileage, your receipts, your text messages, a transcript of everything you've said in one day, your emails, and I'll show you your religious witness. I don't even want to say religious witness. I just want to say I'll show you your witness, or your religious commitment, if you like. As the Palmolive commercial once put it, we're soaking in it, religion. Or as Beck advises us, don't believe everything that you breathe. You know that line from Loser? Don't believe everything that you breathe. Or as James Joyce's Leopold Bloom posits concerning the inevitable communism of our imaginings, disavowing a too knowing knowingness concerning one's own thought processes with an aphorism, never know whose thoughts you're chewing. Shows up in there at one point. This is the religious situation for alleged informant and alleged researcher alike, or as Manuel reminded us yesterday, there's no jumping out of our own skins, you know, in it to win it. That's what I was thinking there. In articulation of this religious situation that seems to draw Joyce and his student McLuhan to the table in one fell swoop, Lewis Hyde offers the following description of this meaning-making scene. The gift, trickster makes this world. Have y'all seen Lewis Hyde? The gift is really something. Whole gift economy deal. It's fantastic. Lewis Hyde, quote, story and song. Story and song. These are two of the hypnotics by which social orders maintain their self-enchantment. The radio playing all day in laundries and gas stations, a background hum of catchy ballads to keep an agreed-upon reality in place and seemingly alive. End of quote. a lived theology, like every form of sacramental poetic. And I'll throw in here, sacramental poetic kind of became my preferred term of affirmation. Before that, it was apocalyptic, which was mostly written in response to the Left Behind fiasco, trying to come up with a different way of talking about these things. And after that, it was cosmic plain speak, way of naming it. And of course, poetry, the news that stays news, that which makes new. When we give Leonard Cohen, at one point, somebody called him a poet, and he said, thank you, but poetry is a verdict. It's not a choice. As in, it is this affirmation that can come to us, but it's not something you want to put on yourself. That would be unseemly. I suppose Christian, we might say that of Christian as well. But anyway, sacramental poetic, just trying to give you a trajectory there. Story and song, a lived theology, like every form of sacramental poetic, will aim to stir the pot of whatever agreed-upon reality lately and momentarily holds sway, but the pot and its contents, the given and received liturgies of a given locale, are never exactly removable. And yes, liturgy, work of the people. I wanted to, this may be part of our thing, but I'll just have to ask you later on. Well, no, I will ask right now. I'm going to think about it. Don't answer it right now because I'm supposed to keep talking. But would you view your book itself as liturgy? And you don't have to answer right now. Liturgies of a given locale, never exactly removable. Religious commitments as currently organized are, in this sense, crucial to the liturgical work to be done. It is what there is to work with, the game you have to be knowingly in to win. Okay, and now as we move toward witness, and I want to refer, you kept talking about bodying forth. Bodying forth was a phrase. Did you say bodying forth? Do I have that right? Bodying forth, Ginsberg and William F. Buckley, I think I need to stray from this in order to keep it interesting. Buckley and Ginsberg, Firing Line, we remember Firing Line? Excellent moment on Firing Line where Ginsberg was going on, and Buckley didn't like what he was saying about the Vietnam War and all that kind of stuff, but he didn't know how to stop him because it was just dizzyingly evocative and beautiful and convincing. And finally he did stop him and said, you know, you can keep on going, but I need to say this. What you're doing is not analysis. It's poetry, but it's not analysis. To which Ginsberg says, poetry is the older form. Just kind of pushed back with that. And Buckley didn't know what to do. But he said, poesy, he throws in, is the older form. So this older form, this is part of what the story and song is, the twin hypnotics for better and worse. Bodying forth brought to mind, maybe you were bringing it out deliberately, the passage in Midsummer Night's Dream, where before we get to the body forth, we have lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. Okay, so the shaping fantasies apprehend more than cool reason, the self-satisfied reason, analytic posture, every comprehends. Analysis is great, but according to Ginsberg's account, it generates analysis. It's the earlier form. But the line that came to mind with that, the poet's eye in fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and his imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown. The poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. That giving to airy nothing, that which was not articulate, or that witness, that voice, that human interest that wasn't available to us before, the poetic act expands the space of the talkaboutable, or conjures that space, making it known to us, available to us. And out of that, to get a, I think that this way of talking, not saying just that it's all poetry, but this giving it an exchanging of witness, if it really is an exchange, takes care of the Donna Haraway, the God trick, where we're pulling a kind of God trick in the story that we're telling through this kind of myth of critical detachment, its own myth in its way. And it could be that it's only a lived theology, to use that as a term of affirmation, but certainly apocalyptic. It's the sacramental poetic work to deliver us from that myth, for all of the harm that it does. I think that also Mary talked about, our analysis is often inadequately fleshed out. Theology is called to be more incarnational. It is an incarnational going if it is that. And that brings to mind a passage in one of the Wendell Berry novels where it talks about this pastor when he's shaking hands, but there's really no connection. Pastor Feltner or something like that. Whenever he shook hands with his parishioners, it was as if the word was protected from flesh rather than made flesh. This question of embodiment here. Okay, I'm going to have to jettison it. Unlearning, finding my... I can't say it. I have to just keep going. Any voice, but placing your voice in there, even analysis, witness, ethnography. Here, I'll have to make it a little more recounting my studies. Horton Spillers. Do we know the name Horton Spillers? She and I read Ulysses, and Joyce's Ulysses, and W.E.B. Du Bois together. And that helped me with this apocalyptic thing a bit. And I'm going to try and draw into some of the stuff that we arrived at together. With Ulysses, a kind of humane ordering of human interests. Ralph Ellison is, I'm just going to have to skip the Joyce part. Du Bois and Ralph Ellison. Okay, Ellison's account of the novel of fiction as being the brightest instrument for recording sociological fact, physical action, the nuance of speech yet achieved. And when we talked of Ellison and Du Bois as witnesses, suddenly she's in the English department, I'm in the religion department, but with this word witness, I can have many disciplines for the price of one word. You can talk about Joyce's witness, Du Bois's witness, Ellison's witness, and it works as a pivot point. And it does the same thing that the Ginsburg Buckley exchange was talking about, and we have this from Levinas on witness, saying bears witness to the other of the infinite, which rends me, which in the saying awakens me, instructs Levinas. Saying as testimony precedes all the said. So testimony, witness, this different way of talking about it. Oh, I just have to skip. We have Benjamin. Joyce prioritizes the lyrical, the way I'm trying to do with sacramental poetic witness, as what the witnessing work at hand demands. And here we're helped by Walter Benjamin's word on witness, where he says, truth is not a process of exposure which destroys the secret, but a revelation which does justice to it. So how to do justice to one's object of study or subject within the story that we're doing is the primary concern that I'm going for here. Black Reconstruction in America, we have W.E.B. Du Bois beginning by describing his complex rhetorical task, saying, in fine, I am going to tell this story as though Negroes were ordinary human beings, realizing that this attitude will, from the first, seriously curtail my audience. Despite his dutiful and painstaking use of primary sources, he knows that those most invested in popular misconceptions of his subject will distort his narrative witness the better to reside comfortably within their preferred abstractions of no-fault American history. And even those who emerge from the reigning-willed myopia to pay him heed will have to pay unaccustomed attention to his account. In his account, Du Bois means to bring the difficult past to the rescue of the ongoingly problematic present, and this work can't begin without undoing the strategic deceptions of the fairy tale of a beautiful southern slave civilization. How to proceed? Every so often within the text, Du Bois indulges a sacramental poetic form, breaking out of his careful, formalized historiography to draw upon the available mythologies that undergird the fairy tale, to seize upon and deploy them differently. And to my mind, he does so most beautifully with a bit of apocalyptic supposition concerning the formal conclusion of the Civil War, the day freedom came to America. That's a quote. For all their self-satisfied and often death-dealing talk of manifest destiny, do Americans actually believe in God? Du Bois submits a picture for our approval. This is a longish quote. Page 715 of Black Reconstruction in America. Suppose on some gray day, as you plod down Wall Street, you should see God sitting on the Treasury steps in his glory with the thunders curved about him. Suppose on Michigan Avenue, between the lakes and hills of stone, and in the midst of hastening automobiles and jostling crowds, suddenly you see living and walking toward you the Christ with sorrow and sunshine in his face. Foolish talk, all of this, you say, of course, and that is because no American now believes in his religion. Its facts are mere symbolism, its revelation vague generalities, its ethics a matter of carefully balanced gain. But to most of the 4 million black folk emancipated by civil war, God was real. They knew him. They had met him personally in the black stillness of the night. His plan for them was clear. They were to suffer and be degraded, and then afterwards by divine edict raised to manhood and power. And so on January 1st, 1863, he made them free. End quote, but I'm about to resume it. So much here. By out-theologizing the reigning God talkers, Du Bois calls their very witness into question, making clear that the avowedly religious among his audience, presuming they mean to be at all serious in their assertions, will have to adjust their imaginations and play to a different calculus if they're to receive this witness. And his lyrical hermeneutic isn't done. The biblical witness will be made to resonate further and more deeply and more comprehensively than any conveniently depoliticized or spiritualized reading of Scripture will allow. Quote continued, it was all foolish, bizarre, and tawdry. Gangs of dirty Negroes howling and dancing, poverty-stricken, ignorant laborers mistaking war, destruction, and revolution for the mystery of the free human soul. And yet to these black folk it was the apocalypse, the magnificent trumpet tones of Hebrew scripture, transmuted and oddly changed, became a brand new gospel. All that was beauty, all that was love, all that was truth, stood on top of those mad mornings and sang with the stars. A great human sob shrieked in the wind and tossed its tears upon the sea. Free, free, free. And in the event, I'm talking now, that we have yet to receive his drift, Du Bois will have us understand that the coherence of Christianity and the redemptive meaning of America itself are at stake in our reception or refusal of the great human sob turned song he discerns. And this resonates very well with the sorrow songs stuff as well. A great song arose. It was a new song. They sneered at it, those white southerners who heard it and never understood. They raped and defiled it, those white southerners who listened without ears. Yet it lived and grew. Always it grew and swelled and lived, and it sits today at the right hand of God as America's one real gift to beauty, as slavery's one redemption distilled from the dross of its dung. Like Joyce, popularly considered a kind of misbeliever, Du Bois nevertheless throws down a metaphysical gauntlet here. What meaning is there in the ascension of Jesus of Nazareth to the right hand of the Almighty if this song prayer, ever ancient and ever new, isn't squarely situated within this eternal elevation asserted by Christian tradition, right hand of the Father thing? Is the Christian hope to be understood as a meaningfully human commitment or not? If it is, then Du Bois offers his provocative account on conventionally religious grounds in the hope that it will be received as actionable intelligence. And he'll talk about the gift of spirit and he ends Souls of Black Folk with this committing of the gift of spirit to our hands, the famous, oh God, comma, the reader, handing it over. If it is, then Du Bois offers his actionable intelligence, a revelation that might serve to overcome the willful amnesia of white supremacist history. In this sense, what I view as the lively apocalyptic of Du Bois' sacramental poetic witness, George Shulman calls prophecy. George Shulman, American Prophecy, Race, and Redemption. Okay. This is Shulman. Prophecy raises the issue of authority with unrivaled profundity and intensity. prophetic voices ask not whether we are ruled by authority, but which authority rules in and through us. Not are you religious, but how are you religious? Probing the contradiction between our alleged or advertised commitments, our self-image, as it were, and the publicly visible facts on the ground, quote, prophecy asks, what gods do you already serve? What is your animating faith? Here is my table of values. What's yours? How much time do I have?
Like three minutes and then questions.
Okay, well, let me just tell you, if I can. From there, lots of, well, I bring Certeau in it, interestingly enough, because Certeau gives us the idea of the call. Here's a great one from Certeau, and if you know the end of Souls of Black Folk, place it in there. The call, Certeau reminds us, cannot be known outside of the response which it receives. It has no expression of its own. I'm going to read that one again. The call, Certeau reminds us, cannot be known outside of the response which it receives. It has no expression of its own. Okay, witness, not just exchange, the possibility of witness. There is no witness. It takes two to mean. Judith Butler, with her language of the structure of address, says no one survives without being addressed. That address is this non-optional sociality thing going on. Okay, and oh, there's just such powerful words concerning the Sorrow Songs. Discourse has no... Okay, I'm just going to have to chunk this one as well. And give you Susan Howe real quick. Poetry is never a personal possession. The poem was a vision and a gesture before it became sign and coded language in a political economy of value. All right, well, the end, here you go. Invisible Man. It's a very under... Have we read Invisible Man? Underground man-like thing, just a constant bardic trance happening. And at the end... Yeah, this is a good one to end on. It's the most powerful ending of any novel ever, because it flips the script, certainly, but it does it in a similar to in Joyce and Ulysses. You have at one point, and you'll have to talk to me later about why I view Joyce as a practitioner of sacramental poetic, but somewhere in there he says, who anywhere will read these words? I mean, you have that in there in the middle of the mess. In Souls of Black Folk, we have the bit that we talked about. And with Ellison, we get to the end here. I'm going to read this part. Toward the end, what else could I do? What else but try to tell you what was really happening when your eyes were looking through? Asked the invisible man. And here he strikes a note of casual inevitability concerning the only tactic available. Tell it true. To one whose existence within the reigning economies of meaning is one of practical invisibility. Quote, without substance, a disembodied voice, as it were. To tell or try to tell what's really happening, to hazard a little cosmic plane speak, to cobble together your own witness box out of thin air, is one way of giving voice, of making believe, of being social. This, too, is a space-making enterprise. In sacramental poetic terms, Ellison names the tension between reality and invention. With a cultivation of creative verse, he means to make a vineyard of the heretofore cursed, and he'll give us the redeeming dialectic. Oh, and I wasn't able to say this exactly, but Hortense is great about talking about critical consciousness as a work to which everyone is invited. And a really nice pivot point for talking about critical consciousness is this last bit. Lest we think of his witness as mere words, Ellison, Invisible Man's witness, as mere words or mere verse, we're reminded that his account bears the critical heft of observational candor. And if we won't see and get in on the drift of his problematic, we're pulling the wool over our eyes. And this actually reminded me of the open door bit. Perhaps your liberation is caught up with mine. Here comes the last sentence. But it could be that the reader is beginning to credit the Invisible Man's narrative with explanatory power, and then credit, make believe, credible. Maybe we do see, perhaps the call is being successfully transmitted. And here's the last sentence of Invisible Man. Who knows but that on the lower frequencies I speak for you. and there's this kind of table set, made ready, available for all takers. And I've got Rich King and Talal Asad and the Berrigans to go. Specifically, the Daniel Berrigan talking about the way I see the world is illegal. And it is. And we've had some reference to this already. But I will end it there. And thank you for listening to me. And I can send this to you.